FSN Radio. It's all about what's next. Go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com and sign up for your free weekly newsletter. You'll also get three free reports. The Financial Survival Network. It's all about what's next.
This episode of the Financial Survival Network is brought to you in part by Sandstorm Gold Royalties. Sandstorm Gold Royalties is a different kind of gold company. They purchase royalties on select mining operations and receive a percentage of the revenue in return. Sandstorm now has a portfolio of over 185 gold royalties around the world. See how gold royalties differ from other gold mining investments at sandstormgold.com. That's sandstormgold.com. Sandstorm Gold Royalties trades on the TSX as SSL and on the New York Stock Exchange American as SAND.
Welcome. You are listening to the Financial Survival Network, and I'm Carrie Lutz, and forgive the sound, but I'm still on the portable studio, and as good as it is, it has its limitations. I can't do noise filtering. I can't make my voice sound better. Not that it needs to necessarily, but hey, as always, feel free to join the show and write us, kl@carrielutz.com. Well, stock market had a nice bounce, you know, up to the mid 24,000 range. And now today it's breaking down right at its 50-day moving average. Never a good sign. Well, here to opine about it is our good friend from jugglingdynamite.com, Danielle Park. Danielle, hey, well, happy Tuesday.
Hey, thanks, Carrie.
So what about this market? It's kind of like following a somewhat predictable course here, isn't it?
Well, yeah, the technical work that my partner Corey did, he did some updated charts when it was bouncing in the first 2 weeks of the year in January. And he said, you know, put the resistance marks at the 50-day moving average, and it's exactly where it's rolling over right now. So, yes, it was a pretty formidable bounce, but it's interesting to note that the rate of decline that we saw in the last quarter of December, Carry, was the most abrupt, sudden drop that we've seen since 1929. So when you have that kind of an extreme plunge, it's very common to get a sort of equally, you know, violent bounce to the upside. And that's kind of all noise, because the point is, you know, does it have legs to continue, or does the drip of negative news, which continues to come out, the growth forecasts that continue to come down, you know, the earnings expectations that have come far down from a year ago, all that sort of is the backdrop to why the news flow, you know, is disappointing. And also the valuations that we came into this cycle at, as you well know, were so extreme that we really had no tolerance or rational ability to ride out the prices at that level. So I think, you know, I'm of the mindset cautiously optimistic, because I realize we've had head fakes in 2012 and 2016, but I really think cautiously that this could be the final break of this bull cycle that began off the lows in 09.
Well, what's also remarkable is we hadn't had any major corrections pretty much in 10 years, Danielle. You know, a 10% break or over, which is what you expect at least like every year or so in a roaring bull market. We had none. So maybe there's a lot of like energy saved up towards the downside, and it'll, well, you're always talking about reversion to mean, but before you have the mean, you have the overcorrection, if you will. And maybe those bears are finally going to have their day, because they sure have been suffering, twisting in the wind and having a painful experience for the last 10 years.
Yeah, I wouldn't say 10 years at all, because there's been years in there where they have all underperformed the more like our approach, which is not to be long always and much more risk sensitive, low volatility. We've definitely had years where we've outperformed the overall benchmarks in there. But I would agree with you that since, let's say, 16, there was a correction in 15 of a fairly substantive size and into the spring of 16. But since then, there's been into 2018, at least, there was a long stretch where the market was leaping higher. And then all of a sudden, as I said, the abrupt reversal. But that really goes hand in hand. And the other thing that people keep, you know, hoping is that the central bank will suddenly switch to a accommodative stance and start cutting rates. But what they fail to appreciate is that the lag of the rate hikes that have already come into the system have already dramatically decreased liquidity in the world. And that's showing up in all the metrics that we follow about, you know, capital flows and cash levels. The investing public came into 2018, about mid-2018, with the highest equity weight for disposable income ever in history, about 55%. Relative to about 20% that they had in 1989. So it really shows you how extreme this cycle has been from central bank pushes and how much excess liquidity drove things, and indeed how much complacency there was when people were piling in, you know, just in the last 3 years as the outlook got worse, they were paying more and more. So that's really a perfect recipe for, as you say, a mean reversion, but again, well below the average. And so I think that it's much likely that we're going to see, we haven't seen anything near capitulation yet. We still have people hoping that it was just a short sell-off and that we're going to see a rebound, even as things like China report the lowest growth rate in, you know, a couple of decades, and even as the European Union looks to be on the verge of recession, and, you know, Canada is weak. So there's a lot of that going around, and still there's hope, market proponents that keep talking about, you know, it should bounce here. So we'll see.
Yeah, well, for sure. So it's down. It went down a good 20%. And this is getting a little protracted, too. This is going on for a number of months, whereas these bounces, you know, those corrections in the past decade have been like a matter of weeks.
If October to December into January was the first leg down of the bear market, the second leg down is notoriously worse. So you do get that bounce period of a few weeks sometimes, and then the next leg down takes out the prior low. So we'll watch very closely for the low in December to be tested, and then we're looking at the low February of 16 would be the next target that we'd be watching.
Yeah, just right the trend line. Just draw the trend line right from there, right?
But, you know, this book, The High Beta Rich, which I've mentioned in the past because it's so essential to understanding the environment that we're in. It was written by Robert Frank a few years ago. But basically it says, you know, the data really supports this again. Right now, I was just looking at it recently. So, not only do the bulk of the people that are owning the real estate that's in decline right now, you know, home sales plunging in North America, both in America and Canada, we've had the first year-over-year price decline in Canada that we've seen in more than 20 years. So that's taking people off guard. But the people that have, you know, the most overvalued real estate tend to be in the so-called world-class cities in the world, where they have the highest debt and living expenses because their realty is through the roof in terms of expenses.
Oh, sure.
And those are still the people that have the you know, the bulk of the money in the equity market. So it is definitely a double whammy when you get these intense periods like we saw in the fourth quarter where real estate's weak. They can't, you know, rates have gone up enough and it's difficult to refinance, as well as the fact that equities took a big hit. So really net worth gets pummeled on all sides. And you see the fallout in things like luxury spending, where, you know, whether it's boats and, you know, airplanes, jewelry, all that stuff has really been in a negative trend as well. There's this sort of a belief that there's a bunch of wealthy people or a lot of wealthy people that are impervious to whether rates go higher because everyone assumes they pay everything cash and have no debt, or they assume that they have so much money that it really doesn't matter. And in my experience, that's not the case at all. When you have this kind of a world where people have low cash savings, even the ones who make the high percentile incomes tend to finance heavily for things like their personal consumption, autos, cars, homes, properties, you know, vacation, all that. So they tend to spend a lot during the boom cycle, take on payments. And then when their asset, whatever savings they do have, is in things like equities and corporate bonds. So when this hit comes on the balance sheet side, they tend to pull back, and then you get, you know, a fall off in not just consumption, but tax revenues that flow from that, and sort of a spiral of having to sell assets into weakness, like, you know, margined portfolios. Sure. And that sort of thing. So we're really highly correlated economically to the financial cycles and to the top percentile earners in this type of environment. And we can thank the central banks for 20 years of their policies that have really created this mess.
Yeah. Yeah. It's pretty shocking. And, you know, I had some friends, the guys I hang out with at Starbucks, and said, well, what do you think I should do here? Like, you know, they've had this tremendous run up in the market. They're all retired. And I said, well, how would you feel if 50% of your portfolio disappeared in a week or a month? I said, well, is it going to change your standard of living? Is it going to change your happiness quotient? And, you know, are you going to have to go back to work? Because if the answer is yes, then you need to do something about it. Because otherwise, you're just acting on emotion and hope and change that the you're hoping the market's going to go back up, and it might not. I mean, nobody knows the future, but we've kind of been to this rodeo before, and we kind of know exactly what can happen. Whether it happens or not this time is in doubt. But honestly, based on what you're saying, Danielle, the numbers you're saying, the reduction, the over leveraging, it's all it's all indicative of a peak. You know, it's all indicative of peak spending, peak earnings,
peak risk seeking. Yeah. And your point is exactly right. I get mail all the time from people who have done these cycles wrong in the past. Sometimes they've done it wrong a couple or three times, where they've been long lots of risk at the peak of a cycle, quit their jobs often thinking they could retire, or even worse, day trade as a living.
Oh, God.
And what ends up happening is, of course, they lose a ton of money because they really had no business being as risk exposed as they were. They really couldn't afford the downside, but they didn't appreciate it, that they were gambling. They thought they were being savvy investors by being long the market. And when these mean reversion periods happen, it devastates their savings so much that a lot of them do have to go back to work. Sometimes people have done that in 2000 and done that again in 2008. And now we're, you know, 20 years later, and they're thinking they're either retired now or about to retire again. And they haven't learned the lesson. They remain long, heavily exposed, thinking dividends are going to protect them from capital losses, which it won't. And it's a very painful process to watch. So you're exactly right. If people have been long risk exposure, they should know that they have been lucky to have benefited on the upside through this huge risk episode, but they will also have to pay back a lot if they don't take cover or take principal protection as the cycle completes.
So would you... You know, obviously, we're not advising people, but somebody who's had this large run-up, would you advise them to hedge at all or just to sell?
Well, you can try hedging. It sounds great in practice. It's extremely difficult to do in reality. I find the very best hedge is to take money off the table and have it in cash deposits, because the figuring out the ratio, basically when you're hedging, you're trying to have a neutral outcome. In other words, you're trying to make zero. You're trying to offset with some things the declines in other things. I find it's more productive for people to actually move to liquid positions, so they don't have to suffer the downside, and then they have the cash and liquidity to buy assets again after they've come off a lot and dividend yields are higher. But even then, the ratio that people should have in these security markets, the ratio of their savings, is a lot lower than people have. I find they really don't appreciate the risk that they face and the extent to which these are casino style conditions a lot of the time. And, you know, they wouldn't take a huge chunk of their net worth to the gambling casino in Vegas, but they'll put a huge chunk of it into markets thinking that's savvy. And that's always a recipe for a lot of pain.
And extending the casino analogy a little bit further, You know, when you go to the table and you do bets to hedge your potential losing at the table, you wind up losing more. And that's what often happens with the hedge, is you don't get it exactly right. And what you hedged for doesn't happen. So you're out on both counts. And I think you're right. The best hedge is to take the money off the table and not risk it. Because if you're not, because I find for my own self, when I've made money in investing, the times where it's happened, it's because I was committed to the investment, not like blindly, not emotionally, but rationally committed. So if you're not really committed to the stock market and you're betting against yourself, then I don't think it's going to turn out well for you. You really have to be some kind of professional to make those hedges pay off.
Yeah. And there's a cost to hedging. So, and you know, here's the other thing. You can get 2.5% right now in a 2-year treasury, or in 3-month treasury, you can get 2.4%. Mm-hmm. You know, there is no shame or foolishness in taking birds in the hand at some point and just saying, you know, I can compound interest here. I can have principal protection. I can have optionality as I go into the future. And if, mm-hmm. you know, if you don't do it now, the question is, when would you do it? And I think the answer is most people don't have a plan to do it ever. Most managers don't have a plan to do it ever. They just think that theoretically they're going to hold through whatever volatility or downturn comes. And in practice, that's almost never the case. People mostly freak out and do the thing at the bottom that they should have done at the top, which is to sell yes. and reduce their risk.
Yeah, there's a game in the casino, really bad odds, called Let It Ride. And the whole point is just keep letting your winnings keep going, parlaying, and then the inevitable happens and you're wiped out. And that is probably what's going to happen in the market, whether it's now, 6 months, a year from now, I don't know. But at some point, the thing has to go down. It's just not designed to go up forever and ever at increasing rates. Anyway, hey, that's it for now. We'll catch up with you soon. We'll make sure you take a look at Danielle's site, jugglingdynamite.com, our site, Financial Survival Network. Write us, KL@carrylutz.com. I've actually got a couple of questions saved up for you, Danielle, back at the office when I return, that I'd like to cover with you the next time we speak. And hey, Twitter feed @CarrieLutz, Facebook page, Financial Survival Network. Danielle, we'll talk to you again real soon. Thanks.
Thank you, Carrie.
FSN Radio. It's all about what's next. Go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com and sign up for your free weekly newsletter. You'll also get 3 free reports. The Financial Survival Network. It's all about what's next.